Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is Friday, the last Friday before Thanksgiving. I don't know why that matters, but anyway, it's true crime time. And I am with Jen. Jen, how are you?
I'm good. You know why it's important? Because any days that put us closer to turkey are good days.
Actually, turkey, mashed potatoes, I'll take it all. I will be at home with a turkey sandwich. Now, the... I am actually going to, I don't know what I'm going to do. Probably get something from Whole Foods. They have some kind of meal thing there. But I definitely have to have my turkey, but I just don't have the patience to cook it for 4 hours. I just don't like that. I do love the holiday. It's my favorite holiday of the whole year.
It's mine too, but I don't think that I'll do a big, you know, spread this year for just myself, you know. None of us are supposed to be going anywhere, so I'll be sitting at home probably with a turkey sandwich that I get from the Whole Foods as well.
You know, and I'm not sure, like, this one, you know, I call it because I like to rhyme, so I would say true crime time. But, you know.
I love that. That's our thing.
True crime. It is our thing. Crime this queen. One's more of a mystery. Sometimes they're more of a mystery, but I can't get that to rhyme. So.
You know what? I'm not good at rhyming. I stumble it over it every time, so I tend to like let you say that. But I love these ones to where you don't know if a crime was even committed.
Exactly.
Like today's story is exactly like that.
Exactly. See, that's what I'm saying. So it's not, you know, it's true crime time, but we're not sure there was a crime.
But maybe there was.
Maybe there was. So we're talking about Philip Taylor Kramer, and why don't you tell us a little bit about him?
Okay, so this case goes back to 1995. You have Philip Taylor Kramer. He was a musician who was in the band Iron Butterfly. He's based out of Los Angeles and I think the San Fran area. And this guy went missing. And there was a lot of weird sequence of events prior to his disappearance that made this just very troubling. And then when he resurfaced, maybe not in the way we wanted him to, it still didn't make a whole lot of sense.
It didn't. And what is great about this case is because he was missing for... you know, 4 or 5 years, is to see the articles that were written speculating about where he went and what happened to him and things like that. And there's some real inconsistencies in the statements that have been, you know, given and everything like that. So when I say, you know, when he was an Iron Butterfly, he was not around for the big hit in Agata DeVita. I mean, he came in after the band had kind of broken up. And by the way, In Agata DeVita, the album that was on, that was the first platinum album ever. So that's something good. So he came in on like the second reincarnation of it or whatever, because there was a promoter and that wanted, said, hey, there's a demand for you guys, so you want to do it. So he joined his best friend, who is named Ron Bushy. And Ron Bushy is one of the people that Philip talked to on the last day that he was making phone calls, or supposedly the last day that he was making phone calls. And so, you know, I mean, he was the bass player. And if you're playing that song In Agata DeVita, you have to be a really, really good bass player. So this was not some guy who, you know, wasn't any good and was just doing it as a favor. He was really good. And he lasted for about 3 years or something like that. And then there was a new bassist, and that bassist actually died of a drug overdose on tour with the band. So yeah, there's a little bit of history with this, but this guy, so you have this bassist, but then you also have this guy that I think we can fairly say that he was a genius.
Yeah, he went on to pursue aerospace engineering. So, yeah, he needed to have a heightened intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, this guy, he knew how to configure the flight paths of nuclear missiles, you know, and he developed this technology to compress and transmit data. He was a student of theoretical physics. He pursued particles and equations that he believed would someday permit objects to move faster than the speed of light, warp speed, which would make possible travel to the stars. Einstein had always said that, you know, there is a maximum amount of speed, and that's like 186,000 miles an hour, which is the speed of light. So this guy is kind of, you know, he's a little bit out there in some of his thinking, but at the same time, he really was a genius. And I think we need to go back to kind of his first job before he started his own company, because he worked at Northrop, which... you know, he had been, what, contracted to work on missile guidance systems.
Yeah, the Department of Defense basically could not get the missile to go where they wanted it to, so they hired him up to figure out what the problem was, and it said that he actually fixed that problem.
Yeah,
and he was he's like a literal rocket science.
He was a literal rocket scientist. And he was obviously working on top secret stuff. And this is kind of interesting to me, is that, so imagine, you know, a normal office kind of thing where everybody's in their cubicles, you know, so just cubicles all around a central area. And this guy's cubicle in Northrop, his cubicle was taped shut, you know, not a door or anything like that, because it's a cubicle system. So it was just all taped shut. And that was kind of a signal to everybody else that, okay, this particular person is working on top secret stuff. It seems to me that if you were a spy and you walked into one of these cubicle farms, you just walk around looking for the ones that are taped up, and those are the ones you want to go to. I mean, it seems like
right.
That's a...
And they mitigate that, and you get like a lot of classes, my understanding, is that they will teach you, you know, don't have anything out in the open, beware of, you know, everything, you know, your screensavers, just your cell phone, don't leave papers out that are classified and stuff. You'll see all this stuff turned over. So if somebody had just walked by, they still wouldn't have seen anything, but you don't want anybody going through your drawers. So they tape it up, you know, as if to make sure that no one comes in. They can tell if the tape is disturbed. They actually take pictures of it and then go back and look and see, oh, is it the same way that we left it?
I did not know that. See, because I'm just trying to, you know, imagine like taping up a cubicle system, and I wonder if you put a little roof on it or whatever. I don't know.
It's a grid system, you know, and they can tell if you breach their matrix. It's interesting.
That is. So... he leaves Northrop and he starts a company called Total Multimedia Inc. And he actually did it with Randy Jackson, not Randy Jackson of American Idol, Randy Jackson, but Randy Jackson of the Jackson 5. And they developed this kind of thing. It was way, way, way ahead of its time, which is why you have to think of, you know, whether or not he was really coming up with the equation for warp speed or not. Because this data compression thing was for CD-ROMs. Remember when we used to have CD-ROMs? And what it allowed was you could take a magazine. He figured out how to take a magazine and essentially compress it all down into a CD-ROM so you could read magazines on CD-ROMs. And then, you know, later it you know, had other applications. But at this point in time, it was so far ahead of the curve that there was no practical uses for it. So the company really didn't make any money. It went bankrupt. It's a hell of a technology, but if there's nobody to, you know, buy it, then it doesn't really do you any good.
I think his genius would lie in taking that and converting to the video side, because today we use that technology for closed circuit television surveillance. You know, say if you're at a gas station, you're pumping gas. If you go back and watch the surveillance of, say, a missing person or something, you'll see that it skips. And you're like, why does it skip? It's because of compression. If it skips, you know, and it only picks up every other step, they can save a lot of space, you know, on the recording. So, you know, that's where the money is. It's always video.
Always video. Nobody, at that time especially, you know, nobody was reading magazines, you know, on a CD. Let me get a CD-ROM of my favorite magazine. You know, it's kind of not really. The technology, good. The practicality of what he was trying to do, not so good. You know, he was married to this woman. And by all accounts, it was a happy marriage. Certainly some of the statements I saw from her later, although grieving, she seemed, like she was really grieving. Sometimes the statements, if they were taken out of context, it seemed like, you know, she just wanted him declared dead so she could move on with her life. You know, they had a couple of kids, and he was telling her that he wanted to work on something significant. You know, and he said what he wanted to work on was, quote, it's very simple. It's been here the whole time. It's so simple that no one has discovered it. Imagine a computer and a camera being able to find a missing child in a sea of thousands of people by just showing the computer a small piece of that child's face and then finding that child in a fraction of a second. Sounds like stuff we have now.
Yes, very similar to facial reconstruction, facial recognition type stuff. And it makes me wonder, you know, the whole time I'm reading the story is, was this really his idea?
Yeah, because, you know, fractal compression, I mean, again, if you, this goes back to his whole compression thing. If you're looking at a sea of faces, you know, that's so many bits of information. So if you could just take that one fragment and then, you know, scan everywhere really, really quickly, that would be a pretty, you know, incredible thing. But it's unclear if this work was for his own company, because I don't see anybody from his own company who ever talked about it, or if it was contracted through an agency, you know?
Yeah, they never make that clear if it was contract work, because when you look at what he was working with at his multimedia company, it doesn't really make sense for him to be working on fractal compression. And I think at one point, even his wife, Jennifer, asked him, you know, what does this have to do with your real job? And he couldn't answer her. And he was doing a lot of work for, say, the FBI at the time, who really would have had skin in the game when it comes to facial recognition and things like that.
Oh, for sure. Because, you know, you have to think about, you know, this is, you know, 1995, and, you know, we've had, by that point, you know, we've had, I don't know if the first World Trade Center bombing, it had already happened, and you had the embassy bombings and things like that. So, I mean, I could see the FBI wanting to use it for counterterrorism and stuff like that. And if you think about what his, coworkers had said, when he was at work, he was at work, but he wasn't ever working on work.
Right. He had a problem because when he was growing up, his father always worked on this one equation, which he called formulae. Okay. And then he went on to work on it, and that's all he did, is he would carry that hobby to his job and he would work on that. So I don't know how he would time to do a hobby when facial recognition would be such an all consuming product.
Right. But I also wonder if he was doing because the business partners never really talk about them doing any work for the FBI or any kind of agency or something like that. So maybe it was kind of, I am working on the equation, but he kept telling them, but he was also working on, you know, this fractal compression thing. But he did tell his dad, he said, if I ever say I'm going to kill myself, don't you believe it. I'll be needing your help.
Phrase alone kind of becomes like the phrase of the family, because the father goes on to say something a lot similar to that to a journalist, but in reference to himself. So again, it's a little suspicious story.
Yeah, he was talking to a Washington Post journalist, and I think he actually gave the Washington Post journalist like an envelope and said, you know, don't share this with anybody or something like that, but you're giving it to the journalist. So I think that they both had an obsession with this equation. And, you know, one of the things that Kramer would talk about is he would talk about the fact that he was working for the FBI. Well, not working, but he would talk about the FBI a lot. So it makes you wonder, okay, maybe he is. Maybe he was just worried that the FBI was following. Maybe he was working for somebody else.
As I read his story, I wonder if they did not consult him maybe one time, maybe twice, on something very specific before moving on to something else. That's how it appears to me. It's a total opinion. It doesn't feel like he was working for them, because this product of facial recognition would have been a multi-million dollar product. He and his company were facing bankruptcies. So he had multiple companies, not just the multimedia one, and they were all going under. To me, yeah, if you're someone that you would have gotten advance up front to work on the project, and then you would have been probably, you know, what, financing towards what you know you're going to rake in after it's released. He doesn't have anything like that.
No. And, you know, they always said, well, he wasn't in it for the money. I mean, when the day he left, he had 40 cents in his pocket, 40 cents. He was a millionaire, technically, because he owned 1.7 million shares or something of stock, and the stock was worth $1. So, you know, so he was technically worth $1 million. But it sounds like he never really had any cash. Things were kind of bad at, you know, with the bills and everything. Not good at all. On the day in question, this last day, February 12th, 1995, he leaves his home in Thousand Oaks, which is where Britney Spears lives, for everybody who wants to know. It's a little bit north of Calabasas on the 101. And he went to LAX, and that's quite the stretch, especially at 9 a.m. You know, that's probably, you know, probably going to take you a good hour. And he was going to pick up this business associate and his wife. And essentially, this business associate was somebody who was on the board of directors and they were trying to oust somebody. And there was another person from the board of directors who was in Vancouver who was also flying down and they wanted to oust somebody different. So this kind of shows you that there, you know, was a lot of infighting in this place. And I'm not sure that Kramer really cared about any of that stuff. You know,
I don't think he did. And the director that they were trying to supposedly oust would have been the one that he favored the most. You know, someone that he had just great camaraderie with, but not exactly someone that was they weren't positive influence in his life by any means. You know, coworkers would go on to say that the guy influenced him in negative ways that may have led to his demise.
So he was going to go to the airport and pick up this couple. And the original plan was he was going to pick them up. They were going to drive back to Thousand Oaks, pick up his wife, and then they were going to drive to Santa Barbara and have a lovely meal up in Santa Barbara, and then who knows what. So he goes to the airport, and I guess he waits there for about 25 minutes, and then he just abruptly decides to leave. And he phoned his wife and said, hey, there's been a change in plans, and that if the guy calls, just tell them to make their way to this Hyatt, which was over by their house in Westlake. And then they would meet them later. And during this drive, after he's left the airport, he makes 17 phone calls while on this drive. That's a lot. And he phoned his longtime friend, Ron Bushy, the one of the founders of Iron Butterfly, and in a distressed tone said, Bush, it's Taylor. I love you more than life itself. That's what everybody called him, Philip Kramer, but everybody called him Taylor. And he then phoned his wife, and during the first call, he said in a really calm and loving voice, when I see you, honey, I have a big surprise for you. I'm not going to see you on this side.
So, yeah, that doesn't sound really kind and loving. You know, hey, honey, guess what? I'm not going to see you anymore. That already explains that he's just like not in his right frame of mind. But she said at that time that she knew in her gut that he was never going to come around her again and that he was not going to meet them at the hotel.
Yeah, I know. She knew that. It's just, it's a weird kind of, when I see you, honey, I have a big surprise for you. But I'm not going to see you on this side. And obviously when you say I'm not going to see you on this side, gotcha. But, you know, to say I have a big surprise for you, that's not the wording.
Because he starts off positive and it's actually a negative. It may have been a positive thing for him. You know, depending on what we go on to find out he was reading, he may have seen this as a good thing. But, you know, of course, his family would have viewed it as something very dark.
Yeah. And it just kind of, it was just kind of odd. And then, like you said, she said that she knew that he wouldn't be meeting her at the hotel or ever. And then he calls her back and says, whatever happens, I'll always be with you. To me, that's pretty, you know, clear-cut kind of thing, I guess, that something bad is probably going to happen.
Well, yeah, and plus, you know, you would know your significant other. When they start talking like this, and depending on the events leading up to this, you would know where they were going. You know, she had some other signs.
And then he calls 911, and this is the strangest one. He said, and there's a recording of the call, and it says, I'm going to kill myself. I want everyone to know that O.J. Simpson is innocent. They did it. And 911 logged the call as being made from somewhere in the San Fernando Valley at right about noon. So if you have him leaving his house at 9, and like I said, at that time of day, you know, an hour, give or take, puts him at the airport at 10, give or take, stays there for about 20 or 25 minutes. So that's 10:30. So it doesn't seem like he really had time to stop anywhere because San Fernando Valley is essentially, you know, getting close to Calabasas and Thousand Oaks and stuff. So, what I find interesting about his location at 11:59 a.m., it's not anywhere near where he ended up being.
Which makes sense because a lot of people along the way and even after his disappearance would go on to say that they thought they had credibly seen him, you know, whether it be at a yard sale, stopping in a computer store, things like that. And it's his height. He was 6'5". So yeah, it was his height that they could remember.
And, you know, I've always been, when you and I do these and somebody goes, oh, yeah, we saw them here, we saw them there, I tend to not believe them, but like you said, 6'5", 225 pounds, you know, you're going to stand out a little bit.
Yeah, that's a lot to hide. But, you know, we know that not all witnesses are credible. You know, we know that from the court systems and witnessing court cases and things like that. But in this case, you know, maybe the one woman at the yard sale said a guy came. He was about 6'5", and he was trying to find clothes to fit him. And this was a couple of days after he had vanished. So to me, he might have been that guy.
It sounds like it to me, because that's this is not somebody, I think I saw somebody walking down the street. This is an in-person communication, probably a minute or two conversation. And going back to that OJ thing just for a second, because it's so weird, because he had told a family member that he had been tasked with validating the authenticity of a videotape that DEA and FBI had on OJ Simpson. And I wonder if that's his one interaction with the FBI, you know, kind of hoping that they would come back. Yeah.
Yeah. They might have asked his opinion on something. You know, I don't know if it's necessarily related to that, but just say that they asked him something about video or, you know, editing or whatever. Could this video be editing? Is it really him? And he may have gave an opinion.
Exactly. Like a little consulting. And then he kind of, you know, maybe he really enjoyed that the fact that they thought of him as an expert or something and kind of hype
exactly.
that up.
And then, you know, say maybe he went on to make a buddy at the FBI, and maybe the guy told him some things that he thought would be in confidence. And, you know, he was going back and telling his family these same stories, but that he was saying, oh, they're my stories. You know,
yes.
So the FBI is working on facial recognition. This one agent's real excited about it. And suddenly it becomes Taylor's project because he develops a habit of doing this, of attaching himself to things that at times are provably not his projects.
Yeah. So we know for 100%, this is before, like, I think cell phone tower tracing and stuff, obviously. But we know he went to the airport because his wife got a letter demanding she pay the $3 in parking fees. He couldn't leave the lot without signing an IOU. So we know he actually did go to the airport. His bank cards went unused, but he was broke. Were they maxed out?
I think so. He had a $250,000 home in Thousand Oaks and tons of bills that people said that he wanted for nothing. The family was constantly on a nonstop spending spree, and, you know, he didn't keep up with finances. He didn't even keep up with day-to-day things that went on in his job. You know, if something came up, he would say, oh, no, la, 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 I can't handle it. And it drove his colleagues crazy. So if he didn't keep up with finance, you know, did it come back to bite him in the rear end? Kind of seems like it did.
Kind of, but I also feel like his wife, knowing that he wasn't kind of good at that stuff, I wonder if she was the one who paid all the bills and everything. And maybe, because, you know, obviously this is not the guy you want in charge of bill paying, because he's probably going to forget to pay them all.
Oh, yeah, he was super forgetful. So, I mean, I wonder the same thing. And it's a really good question, because this is a guy who was so lax in details that when they told him to go to a meeting in Hawaii, he accidentally boarded a plane to Atlanta.
I know, that's nuts.
He was like, oh, sorry, I read it wrong, or I didn't read it at all.
It's hard to confuse Hawaii and Atlanta. And then there was a man, I guess, who thought that he saw Kramer browsing through the computer store, but he didn't purchase anything. Then there was a couple in Agora Hills, which would also make sense. It's in the same region, who claimed they were approached by him, who told them he was in trouble and needed to call his family, but he only had 40 cents. You know, he could have called collect. This was when they still had payphones everywhere.
Yeah, I don't know why he didn't do that. But the fact that they mentioned 40 cents is significant, because he had told his father the day before he disappeared that he would like to borrow some money to take his own children out to lunch that he couldn't afford to, because he only had 40 cents in his pocket. So
and
when
the dad said no.
Yeah, unfortunately, his dad is a jerk. He's like, no, I didn't raise you to be like that. You're not going to ask me for money. And the dad is just self-absorbed.
You know what I found interesting when I was reading one of the articles while Kramer was still missing, is that the dad had actually set up an office inside the company. I just thought that was kind of a weird little thing. You know,
yeah.
Why don't you just get
you
home?
Read what he did while he sat at his son's desk at his company. He wrote his own book about that stupid formula. To me, the whole thing is like, you know, if your family member comes to you and they have never come to you before, and they're normally somebody that has a good performance level and a good bank account, and they said, hey, can can I have $5 for lunch? Listen, they need $5 for lunch. Like this guy, I tend to think if he had a little more family support, he might still be here today.
Yeah. So that's why when you read the statements from his wife, you're like, some are good, some don't feel as good. But then, but he called his wife supposedly 16 days after he went missing. And she describes him as sounding completely out of it. All he said was hello, hello before hanging up.
Yeah, I wonder if that was location, if he couldn't hear, or if he was really that far out of it. You know, if he hadn't ate and he was dehydrated and stuff, maybe he was on his last leg.
Now, they don't give an exact timeline of when this possibly happened, but I guess he made one stop on the morning of his disappearance to this medical center to visit his terminally ill father-in-law, so his wife's dad. And he pulled a small object from his pocket and explained that it was a viewing device whose lens replicated and fragmented anything it perceived. And he goes, it's all right here. I know you'd understand, but it's all right here. And then he handed his dying father-in-law the amazing device, and it was just this cheap plastic child's toy. I mean...
Yeah, so there you have the delusion of someone who is disclosing information to someone he doesn't view as a threat, because after all, he's going to die. But the thing is that he is saying that it's something amazing that the whole world would want to see. And in reality, much like the formula that he and his father both worked on, it's not. It's just one of those cheap plastic kaleidoscopes like you'd get in your Happy Meal from McDonald's, I don't know, in like the 80s or something.
So do we believe that the 16-day phone call happened?
I don't know. I mean, would the wife lie about that? She's already said, you know, hey, look, this is my situation. He wasn't acting exactly right. I don't know. I mean, for the longest time when I looked at this case, I wonder if it was really him calling. But I assume that it was because, you know, she said he was out of it. I assume she knows what her husband sounds like. And the couple in Agoura Hills seeing him in the 40 cents, only he would have known
that
story.
Pretty rock solid right there. You know, for them to bring up the 40 cents when nobody else knew about the 40 cents.
Yeah, having that little backstory helps me a little bit clarify that, yeah, that's probably him.
So what I find interesting is that, let's say the 16 days, let's say it was him. This guy was so obsessed with the formula and everything and having a, you know, access to a computer where, you know, because he would stay up all night just like running back and forth to his computer to do like complex math equations, right? Is that I can't imagine that at some point, he didn't want to just go to the office and use the computers there or something just because of his obsession with the formula, because he wouldn't have been able to do it anywhere for 2 weeks. And this was a guy that just lived off that formula. And that's what I kind of find odd about it. And
this formula, you know, was meant to be his bailout ticket, you know, his multi-million dollar idea. His father had filled his head with such garbage this whole time about how it's the formula and all that. And scientists, real life scientists, were telling him it's not going to work. You know, it's not feasible. Let it go. Let that be your hobby. You know, don't become immersed in it. And he literally fell down the rabbit hole of this. And I think one day he may have woke up, total opinion, and said, this is not the ticket. You know, and if someone freaks out after learning something like that, you know, they might run off the way he did. I mean, this guy, he went on a hike with his wife the day before he disappeared. And he looks at a cross that he sees across the street, and he's like, look, honey, our house is right in the path of a cross. And she said he was just starting to see sacredness in everything. Everything was amazing. Everything was brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, and then that's the, I mean, that was so kind of odd. And, you know, that's the day, like you said, that he tried to take the kids out to lunch and, you know, and the, it was weird was he, you know, I guess he went to his dad's house to ask because the dad said no and go home and get some sleep. You know, because the dad said he was exhausted and he was burned out. And then his wife said, you know, he had tried to sleep, but kept getting up and running to the laptop to run this math equation. And so this was, you know, the night before he disappeared, you know, and his wife kept asking, you know, how does this equation have anything to do with your company? And, you know, she feared that his mind was gone.
Which, and perhaps she was right. He had not slept in 2 weeks straight. And his colleagues worried also if he was losing his grip on reality, he would bounce into the office early in the morning, just really, really chipper, even though they claimed that he wasn't using any substances. And he would just be over the top energetic. And then he would kind of burn out when it became like 6 or 7 p.m. And despite needing to go home because it's a 9-to-5 job, he would burn the midnight oil so late. And they were like, when do you sleep? You know, if you don't sleep, it'll eventually make you psychotic.
Yeah. And you can see it happening. But that's why I wonder, I come back to the whole time when he decided to go missing, that, you know, was he sleep? He must have finally slept, I would imagine, because he's not running these equations all the time or something, you know? And he didn't have any official enemies, really. But, you know, if he was working on sensitive projects, you know, he could have had a bunch of unofficial enemies, you know, or people who would have benefited or rested easier if he wasn't around. And one of the theories when he was missing was this guy named Jim Trafficant, and he was a congressman from Ohio who wore a really bad toupee most of the time and was arrested by the FBI for a bunch of things, and he defended himself and he ended up going to jail for 4 years. And this was probably in around 2001-ish is when he went to jail. And this would have been just, you know, a little bit after we find Kramer. And one of the things about Trafficant is he was convinced that Kramer had been snatched by a foreign government. I mean, he was convinced. He was all out on that. And one of the things is that Trafficant, what he really, really believed is that, he said that he had all the secrets about Waco, Ruby Ridge, Pan Am Flight 103, Jimmy Hoffa, and the John F. Kennedy assassination, which he was going to divulge in the future. And there is this author who, wrote a book called Target Trafficant, The Untold Story. And it's kind of crazy. And then right after this book was written, Trafficant essentially is killed. He dies in this very mysterious tractor accident. And I say it's mysterious because this tractor he was driving into a pole, into a barn, I guess, flipped over and trapped him underneath. And everybody assumed, oh, he had a heart attack. His family assumed that he had a heart attack. Some people thought, oh, well, maybe he's drinking, maybe he's on drugs or something like that. So there was nobody there to witness the actual accident. And it turns out that he didn't have any drugs or alcohol in his system. He hadn't had a heart attack. And the coroner finally said, well, it was probably asphyxiation because of the fact that he couldn't get the tractor off of him. But the problem is he lived for, 4 days after it. So, you know, it was just kind of interesting that you had this guy who's this huge, huge supporter of the theory that Kramer had been kidnapped by a foreign government, and then has all these things that he said that he wanted to tell the truth on, and then he ends up dead. And one of the other things that he had supported up until the time he died is that concentration guard, the guy who moved to Ohio. It was Netflix. They did The Devil Next Door, and he was a big supporter of that guy. It was just, it's kind of weird that the one guy who was really, really supporting him and also has all these theories, ended up dead in kind of a interesting way. And Trafficant's body is buried in an undisclosed location.
Ah, so, why did they feel the need to hide his body? That's interesting.
I don't know. That's right. They had a private funeral. No public funeral for a guy who was extremely popular, a guy who got 15% of the vote while he was in prison, when he ran for Congress from prison.
Wow, is this like so, a reminiscent, I mean, of, I don't know, like Danny Casolaro? Maybe he was following those octopus tentacles places that he need not follow.
You know, why would you? You know, undisclosed location.
Yeah, don't look into that stuff.
Yeah, this is somebody who was extremely popular with you know, a lot of people in that part of Ohio. And I mean, they would have turned out in big, big, big numbers for him for a public funeral, but none. And
That reminds me of Ted Gunderson, the FBI agent that died under mysterious circumstances. They thought it was kidney disease, but the coroner saw the black tips of his fingers, which lets you know it was arsenic. And he also was doing what that guy was doing, looking into a lot of stuff at one time. And I tend to think they got that one.
So anyway, I didn't mean to get distracted. I just found that kind of interesting that the one person and then I always knew about Traficant and everything. I hadn't really thought about, you know, how he died or anything. I knew that he had died. But then when I started looking in, I was just, okay, that's a little bit odd. You know.
Yeah, that's a rabbit hole within itself.
I didn't mean to distract us like that.
No, that's okay. But this Kramer guy, he was reading this book that they were passing around at the multimedia company, and it was basically supposed to be required reading, and it was called The Celestine Prophecy. And it was by James Redfield, and it was introduced to him, and he just became glued to this book. And if you read it, it basically culminates with people entering a magic flow, and then their beings becoming pure energy. In the end, they just disappear.
That's kind of, yeah. I mean, and then in the margin of the book, he wrote, "I look forward to death's release. I haven't the guts to take this moment upon my hands."
And see, that's sad. To me, that's someone that is just maybe so overworked and so under pressure. He said his entire life, you know, he needed to live up to his father's expectations. And, you know, that's sad because, I mean, if he felt like that he was falling just short, you know, was he suicidal? It kind of sounds like he was.
I think that this whole thing at work just kind of was crushing. And I think that the infighting of board of director stuff, I mean, this guy's a scientist. I don't think he really cares. He doesn't care about the business stuff. He doesn't care about the money. He just wanted to do the science stuff. And, you know, to have to go pick up a guy who wants to oust your friend, and there's another guy coming down who wants to oust somebody else. And, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, but when you're a musician and then you move into aerospace engineering, you got to put on your big boy pants. You know, you're up there with defense contractors and stuff. You can't be loosey-goosey anymore. And this guy was going around. He wagged this book around everywhere, and he was just saying, "God's a scientist, a perfect scientist." He was constantly doing all these quotes, which, you know, again, had nothing to do with his job, and he was driving people crazy. He told his sister, "You've got to be centered." And then he drew a heart, like, across his chest. It was like, if you're centered, you'll be saved when the supernova comes.
I know. Here's the thing. Is like, he said that in a previous life, he and his bosses had been brothers. And one of the bosses kind of said, yeah. And others, you know, they were like, "Come on, stop talking about past lives and shamanism and things like that." And they wanted the one who was saying, you know, who kind of encouraged him to do that. That's the one that they wanted to go, right? They wanted that director to stop. And, they wanted the
supernatural stuff at work to stop also. You know, it was just way too much talk about, you know, being spiritual and what's beyond. And they said they should have stopped it long before, you know, this guy disappeared.
And then he called a friend and told her that he could channel the 10th insight of the Celestine Prophecy, a sequel that hadn't been written yet. And it was so crazy that the friend grabbed paper and wrote as he spoke, "Learn from the beauty of the eye that beholds all the wonders of the world and yet is blind unto itself. The difference is between day and night." And, he was really excited that he had been able to interpret it because it was, quote, highly encrypted or something like that. But then you get to something weird because he starts telling his wife that people were after him.
They're after me. Who? Them.
Yeah.
Them, you know, I don't know.
Exactly. And he said, you know, "We need to move to a house with high walls." And then, you know, she said that he was manic and he would jump up with glee as he told her, "I've finally proven that my father's theories for the last 35 years are correct. Me, your husband."
Yeah, he also said, "I believe that the Clintons are going to be on a plane anytime now to come down and congratulate me, the equation." She's looking at him because she knows this equation is not going anywhere. And she's like, "Look, no, this is not a thing." You know, I would have grabbed him by the hand and been like, "Okay, that's it. Like, go lay on the sofa. You're going to talk to someone."
You just get a sleeping pill, you know, give him a sleeping pill, you know, something like that. You know, And he told his wife that he feared the presence of patent attorneys at his office, but there's no mention of him holding any patents for any of his miraculous findings.
I looked it up. He does not have anything. So I don't know why he feared them unless something that he was claiming as his was not his. And when the patent came out of who actually did own it, people would be very disappointed.
So the unexplained, unsolved mysteries, even Oprah, they all featured, you know, his disappearance. And for 4 years, nobody knew who he was. 4 years. So you have all these articles and everything. I encourage you to go back and read the articles from, say, 1995, 96, you know, and just, where is he? Where is he? Kind of thing. Because it's such an interesting thing. People kept writing about it. Plus, the internet was already out. So it got spread that way, too. But on May 29th, 1999, his rusted minivan was discovered at the bottom of Decker Canyon near Malibu by photographers looking for old wrecks. And inside the van were his skeleton remains, and he was identified through dental records and based on forensics. And also, you know, just everything that happened, they just said it's a probable suicide. You know, he died of a blunt force trauma that may have been consistent with him driving his van off of the cliff. But the coroner couldn't say for certain. You know, the part where he was killed is it's not even in Los Angeles County, actually. It's Malibu stretches up the Pacific Highway, and it's actually, this was in Ventura County. And if you want to cut across, see, this is the thing. If you want to cut across to the 101, you have to go up through the mountains, and there's only a couple roads to do it on. And a lot of those roads have really, really big drop-offs. So, which is why the photographers were going down there looking for wrecks. It is not uncommon. You know, I just...
Yeah, so after he dies, right? And then his wife, this is why she's so bitter. You know, she does love him, but she becomes bitter because he had told her he was worth millions, and she's depending on now the stock and things that he has said to help her through the tragedy and also to help raise his kids. And when she looks at things, nothing that he says was true. You know, he didn't own any patents to anything. He's not worth millions.
No, I mean, he had 1.7 million shares or whatever at $1 a share. But then when he was reported missing, because he was the brains of the whole place, the stock crashed to 7 cents a share. So, I mean, that's still, you know, 150 grand. But the problem is that she couldn't cash in on his life insurance until he was legally dead. And you have to wait 7 years for that. And I feel as if he had a very large life insurance policy, which was probably really frustrating to her. You know, because, you know, all these bills, and, you know, if you think about not only the personal bills, but in a company that's failing, there's going to be a lot of business bills, that are coming in, and he didn't, you know, own any rights to any work. Anything he was contracted to do was the property of the contracting agency. You know, the FBI looked into the disappearance, and they said there was no reason to suspect a kidnapping plot, especially by an adversary. That was at the request of Traficant. He got the FBI to look. So.
And see, and that's kind of telling too, because you have the FBI saying, no, the foreign adversary thing is, it's not a thing. To me, they were looking in and without saying it. You know, he's not working on anything that sensitive, or he's not working on anything sensitive at all. You know, that it does not factor in. So that's kind of telling.
You know, and when he spoke of research, was he talking just about the equation? You know, because, you know, this equation, it had no value, really. It would have been just like the CD-ROM thing. If he could figure it out, great. But what are you going to do with it? You know? Just because you can figure an equation, you know, people knew that you could possibly fly, but they didn't have the technology to be able to make it work, right? Until a certain amount of time.
Right.
So, you know, so the dad worked on the equation his entire life. He was a professor and everything. And so the son became obsessed with it. Just like if a father is obsessed with a football team or a sports team, sometimes the son will become obsessed with that same team. Other times they hate their dad so much they pick an opposite team. But in this case, you know, this was the thing. And it was all about this universal speed limit, the 186,000 miles per second or whatever. And, you know, he was obsessed with it. And, you know, he wanted to travel to the stars and things like that. And I'm not even sure how the dad could write a book about it, you know, honestly, because how can you write a book about something that doesn't actually exist? You know, it's just a formula.
I mean, realistically, he shouldn't. If it's sci-fi, sure, slap that on there as fantasy, because to me, this is riding a big wave of fantasy. Their idea was to reach the stars, and real scientists will tell you with the information they have at this time, you know, the distances are simply too great. And that equation is just not going to be something you can bend right now and make star travel, you know, a thing. So, look, I don't know why they carried it this far, but look, we're in 2020 and their equation is still not a thing. So I don't believe the scientists were wrong.
No. But now Ron Bushy, the guy from Iron Butterfly, he believes that somebody put a gun to his head because he just made a breakthrough in this new technology. But even if he had, let's say he had, it's not good. It's like his wife said, it has nothing to do with your company. It has nothing to do with anything that you're working on or anything to make us any, you know? You know, he had, you know, gone through this range of, you know, emotions and I guess he was telling her some lies and things like that.
You had something that was so incredible that it would change the world or it would change scientific advances or something like that. The last thing you would do was go off yourself. I tend to think that he had taken, I call it a long con, just way too far. And when he could not possibly find anything in between to help him make money, you know, to keep this fabrication going, then he gave up. You know, I think that's when he went off and thought, okay, well, I can't ask my parents for money and how are we going to pay rent and stuff? Because she goes on after he's missing to start receiving some pretty hefty bills. And it looks like they were behind, you know, for all intents and purposes, they were behind on their bills. And, you know, I don't know if she was the bookkeeper or just keeping up or just stepped in last minute, but I don't know. It just tends
I think she was keeping up, but I think that she thought that he had more stock or something. That may be the one thing that she didn't know is, you know, how much stock he actually had, you know, anything like that. And he probably was worth millions, but he was worth millions dead with the life insurance thing. I'm sure it was like a key man life insurance kind of thing. So, you know, it was probably worth a few million dollars, which is probably why it was so frustrating. But if you think about that company that he started with Randy Jackson or whatever, I mean, so he's this enthusiastic guy, kind of like every day that he was at work, you know, starts off enthusiastic, and then you have this, you know, this arc of promise, and then just kind of sputter into failure. And that's essentially how he lived every day, but it's also kind of his career arc, you know?
Yeah, because one of his business partners described him just like that. He just said that he had a tendency for leveraging the future on his dreams, and then somehow it would always end in a collapse scheme.
Yeah, I mean, that's just kind of the thing. And it was, but while he was gone, I mean, it was just kind of, you know, everybody's like, okay, was he kidnapped? You know, was there a UFO crash? You know, just those kind of things, right? And at the time, when they were writing articles, they said, well, you know, he had no history of psychiatric problems. But, you know, if you listen to his wife, just because you haven't, you know, seen a psychiatrist or, you know, or anything like that, it doesn't mean that you don't have psychiatric issues.
Right. You know? And they can be developed also if someone's under intense pressure and they're constantly just falling short of their goal. You know, they can eventually develop psychosis. And I think that's something that they maybe should have looked into with him. And, you know, if he had gotten medicine, maybe he could have been saved. It's a really sad story. And you know what? I think the conspiracy, like, tell me if you agree. The conspiracy is a lot bigger. You know, you think, oh, you know, this guy really could have been murdered for all the secrets that he knew because he was telling these stories. But you have the wife, you know, kind of like the supporting person in the background telling you there was problems leading up to this. You know, he was acting really weird. He's reciting all this strange stuff. He thought people were after him. And, you know, she lives in the same house and she said nobody was after them.
Yeah. You know, and people, when he was missing, they were looking in the lyrics for Inagata De Vita to see if there's any clues and things like that. But again, he didn't have anything to do with that song. I mean, he played it a lot on tour and obviously, but he didn't actually write it or anything. So,
they were trying to help.
Yeah. So what are we thinking? We're thinking, I don't know if it was a suicide or he just, you know, the car went off the cliff or whatever. I mean, that could have also been true. But I'm going to go with the suicide because of the fact that, if it was an accident or something, and he's just driving, he only has 40 cents. So how much driving can he do? And they said that he didn't use any of his cards. So, you know, he's got this Ford minivan that he drove for 2.5 hours already, or 3 hours. So, I mean, it could have been full at some point, but he never filled it back up. I'm going to go with suicide.
Yeah, I think it's suicide too. A case of snapped, you know, someone who was drove to madness and then subsequently, you know, drove to death. And, you know, he may have drove off the cliff because he had not slept. You know, he might have just misjudged, or, you know, someone's just so out of their mind, they don't understand the repercussions of going off the cliff. You know, if he made a sharp turn, that was it.
Yeah. You know, so, and, you know, you could go back and you look at the Northrop stuff. I mean, when he worked there, he had to swear a national security oath. So, I mean, it was definitely, you know, getting the missile to fly accurately. That's about all anybody really knows. But the problem is that was kind of far removed from where he was now, you know. So I think that if he was going to be kidnapped by a foreign government or something like that, they would pick somebody who was in the job then at that time rather than several years earlier.
People had thought that he was kidnapped by an adversary and that he was working for them. And that's why he had disappeared. You know, once he showed up dead at the bottom of that canyon, that story kind of faded.
Yeah, you know, I mean, what he did was great. I mean, he wrote the computer code to monitor the telemetry, but, you know, 4 years later or whatever, they probably had new code. So he's not really the person that you want to necessarily, you know, kidnap or whatever to get him to come work for you. So yeah, I'm going to go with suicide. It's a sad one. For sure. I just, you know, it's somebody who got obsessed, didn't sleep, and just, didn't get help. You know, I wonder if his wife said, you know, you need to get some help.
I feel like she did. You know, maybe she approached him and said, hey, you know, you have an unhealthy obsession with this one thing. You know, you're abandoning everything else and neglecting your day-to-day duties for this one thing. You need to, you know, talk to someone about it. But, you know, maybe he did. Yeah. He approached his father. His father was not very understanding.
I mean, anybody who, you know, in their 911 calls, you know, says, and OJ didn't do it. You know, I mean, kind of. Okay.
And you have to think, like, I wonder if he was in the right frame of mind where he knew that was going to be recorded. You know, that was going to be his legacy. It's really odd.
You know, they did it. Who's they? You know, just because, yeah, I just, it's interesting. Anyway, I can't wait to see what we find for next week for, I already know what we're doing next week for Thanksgiving. I already know which show we're doing. Ooh, it's one of my, last week we did one of your, all-time favorites, and next week we're going to do one of my all-time favorites.
Yes.
A very special potluck. I'm excited to talk about that person for an hour.
Me too.
So I hope that you have a great weekend. I hope that everybody else out there has a great weekend.
Yes. Thank you. And, everyone stay safe.
Stay safe. Talk to you later. Bye.